Hello, I'm Vontone Quinlivan, CEO of Futuro Health, welcoming you to Workforce RX, an ongoing conversation with leaders and innovators offering insights into creating a future-ready workforce. According to the U.S. Department of Labor, registered healthcare apprenticeships are up 43% in the last 5 years as employers turn to, quote, earn while you learn models to fill staffing gaps that traditional degree pipelines aren't filling fast enough. Today, we're going to highlight an institution that's a great example of this trend by speaking with Michael Jones, Director of Workforce Development at UCSF Health, the second largest employer in the Bay Area here in California. He just recently received the Chancellor's Exceptional Service Award, so congratulations, Mike. In that role, Mike has led new initiatives to prepare historically underrepresented communities for healthcare careers in partnership with employers, educators, and other stakeholders. One example is a new radiology technologist pathway program that I'm eager to learn more about. Thanks very much for joining us today, Mike.
Thank you, Vaughn. I really appreciate the opportunity to connect and have a discussion around what I considered one of the most important aspects of our strategy for workforce going forward as not only a city, but also as a state in the country. Really happy to be here.
Well, I can't wait to learn about the best practices that you're deploying. But before we start talking about career pathway programs, I'm curious about your own path. What drew you to this space and also your current role at UCSF?
Thank you for that question. It was really serendipitous. I often tell people that my first paid job was a coat check clerk. And I had the privilege of being able to work in environments where I first learned the importance of customer support and customer service. I also learned the importance of being able to understand the skill set and the value that you brought to an employer. And if I took a step back even further than that, just looking at my own parents, my mom and my dad, great examples in my life growing up. Their journey to where they ended up in their professional career was only a testament, in my opinion, to career ladders and the steps that they took. Both of my parents started off in hospitality and they were in the proverbial front of the house. They supported most of the local maintenance and most of the local property management work that was required for one of the major hotel chains. And through years of working in that organization, they managed to move all the way through into leadership positions. And at the time, I didn't recognize that that was what a career pathway and a career ladder looks like. But for me, when I got the chance to actually start my own career, I was able to reflect on that experience and seeing how great my parents were in their career journey and understood very clearly early on that the skill sets that I was learning in my early teens and my late teens were applicable to the jobs that I would like to do at that point. It did not mean that there were not other opportunities to continue to advance my skills, and I had to be very prescriptive about what that meant. So being prescriptive and being understanding that the skills and tools that I needed to develop were not just about just-in-time strategies, but rather, what is the market saying that it needs in the next 5 years? What is it saying that it needs in the next 10 years? And through that, I found myself doing a lot more work with local municipalities in the Midwest. I also then worked with a major CPG organization, Walgreens Boots Alliance, where I was sat at the corporate office overseeing some of the, or collaborated, I should say, in some of the work that oversaw the recruitment strategies for the 8,000 stores that we had at the time across the nation. Through that experience, two things really clicked for me. It showed that business strategy, when it's done right, could have a direct impact on the communities, not only locally, but nationally. And secondly, it also showed me that the communities that we were working in at the time at that organization, they had really good ideas about what made their communities work. They had really great ideas about what careers and what skill sets were necessary. And so I took that information, I took that opportunity to learn that, and I moved it into my next opportunity, which was at a local academic health system in the Midwest. And through that, I worked in place-based strategies. And oftentimes, you may hear me say individuals from disinvested communities. Disinvestment is regardless of race, ethnicity, gender, or any other protected class. Disinvestment specifically means that the industries that held that community together, that held that city together, through one mean or the other, you know, they had to decide to withdraw or dismantle or reduce the impact that they were having in that area, which then subsequently left individuals who were trained in that environment or that industry without an opportunity to grow their career or to support their family. And so my life work, I like to say, is that I focus on communities that were once thriving, but now have the opportunity to pivot and really advance even further in the work that they're doing. All of this work led me to UCSF, where I've now had the privilege of being for 5 years, working with an amazing team in the Anchor Institution mission work that's being led by Wiley Liu. And under that umbrella, and also in a direct correlation with our HR teams, we have been able to make substantial gains in supporting individuals from the local San Francisco community, regardless of race, ethnicity, gender, and being able to attain family-sustaining wages. And we did this not in a vacuum. We did this through direct partnership with local entities that knew the environment, that knew the communities, that knew the challenges, and also knew the solutions based on what community members had shared in the past. And so by partnering with those organizations, I took a direct lens in terms of what are the opportunities within UCSF that we need to gain greater foothold in to better support our patients and their families. And in understanding that, how do we pair that with the community members that are seeking growth opportunities? I'll give you one quick example of this, and this is around our Excel program, for example. Our Excel program is excellence through community training, where we support individuals in being able to get into what we consider a medical administrative assistant role. These are the individuals that you see at the front desk when you first walk into a clinic or when you call a clinic to schedule an appointment. And we created a strategic partnership with a local Bay Area nonprofit. And through that partnership, we've been able to see hundreds of individuals move from, at times, 300% below the poverty level into family sustaining wages and even into management opportunities at the organization. And so once again, it's not saying that what we are doing has to be so radical and so phenomenal that it is recreating the wheel. It's simple. We understand what our demand is. We understand what our internal needs are. We just have the opportunity right now to pair that with the community and what they're also seeking. And this is why I believe organizations like Futuro has a very strategic position within the future of work, and how we design workforce strategies that are uplifting communities and uplifting organizations equally.
Well, I thank you for the call out of Futuro Health. And then we are also so pleased that you were able to share some of your story with us and what shaped you and your approach to workforce development. I'm wondering, and I think many listeners will wonder, so from within, you had to convince internal stakeholders to work with the community, which is your phrase. Tell us a little bit more on like how you decided when you first started this work, where to focus or which occupations or which business unit to focus on. I would love if you could decode that for some of the listeners.
Absolutely. I think with large organizations like ours, what you will find is that you have two very distinctive communities. You have your internal communities, which are every single person that considers you their employer and that they love showing up to work for every day. That is your first community. And then you have your second community, which is everyone outside of that four walls that you support, that you really want to make sure that continues to thrive in the environment that you're in physically. And once we understood that there were two different communities, all with the same desire to advance and to grow and to deepen their knowledge, we had to take a step back and understood that the approach may be different. For example, for an incumbent individual that is currently employed with the organization, they may need added support around days off so that they could continue their education and that their department still has the efficiencies that they need, where they're not missing staff time. So supporting back wages, supporting backfills for that individual's department, et cetera. And then your other community, equally as important, they may need additional support when it comes to deeper wraparound support, such as maybe transportation, food insecurity support, et cetera. So by mapping all of these different potential categories of needs, it helped my team and I better prepare for how we show up and show up really good to the people that we were supporting. Now, the easiest part of this process was getting UCSF leadership on board. And the reason why I'm saying that it was really easy is because when I started 5 years ago, going on 6 years now, We had so many individual unique programs that were operating on their own because people were so motivated, and they still are motivated, to do really good work in the community. What my job and my team's job then became was to ensure that we were all communicating. We were all having similar strategies, or at least an administrative strategy that says what we do and how we do it needs to be aligned so that there is consistency amongst the programs. And we've been able to really ensure that from an administrative level, that when we show up, we're providing equal or same services and offerings to individuals internally or externally. But I will say that our leadership team has consistently over the years invested and really made opportunities available for individuals who are either getting upskilled or getting trained to come into the organization. It's a phrase that many listening to this podcast may have heard before, but it's the outside in, inside up strategy. And it's really making sure that we are removing barriers. We're not lowering job requirements. That is definitely not what we're doing. What we're looking at is if we have somebody that's qualified for the job and they need to show up on Monday morning for the first day of their shift, do they have the resources necessary? Do they have childcare support? Do they have transportation support? Do they have clothing that matches the environment that they will need to be in? And so these are the things that I will say that we are very keenly aware of, and that we try our very best to ensure that we're supporting individuals equally. And once again, when I mention community, it has no semblance to race, gender, ethnicity, because I believe that when the tides rise because of the work we do, all boats lift equally. And I think that the work we're doing is, yes, being done by UCSF, but all of our other healthcare colleagues in the Bay Area, I think, also benefit from what we are collectively doing. Because the way I see it is we could train 10 individuals to be medical assistants, for example, and 9 out of the 10 may decide to come to UCSF as their place of employment. The other one individual is a net benefit to the entire region, because now that is a well-trained individual that could go and support another one of the healthcare facilities in the area and support in patients who are the direct outcome of all the work that we're doing.
Let me pull on one of the threads that you mentioned, which is if it's an incumbent employee, they may need some release time or backfill time. And so the mechanics of that, I understand that you report into the anchor institution leader. Is that a centralized budget that you're able to provide back wages, or is that a decentralized practice that UCSF has? What do you recommend?
I'll start with what I recommend, and then I'll describe what we have internally. So what I recommend for any organization, whether you're in healthcare or not, I think your workforce that you currently have is a captivated audience. You hired them for a reason. You hired them because they were skilled to do the job, and you invested the time and resources to get them there. And so to ensure that you have a centralized budget, which is what I recommend for any organization listening, is a key factor. Because that centralized budget helps you to ensure that you have key metrics and key measures that are put in place and equally distributed to anyone that is working within your organization that may want to take part. Some organization may allocate, you know, several thousand dollars for educational reimbursement. Others may allocate a full dollar amount to ensure that you get reimbursed for your education as well as your time away. What we've done at UCSF is that we have both a centralized fund that is supported through HR, and it's also policy driven. And then third, we have a strategy where we've engaged with external philanthropic organizations that have been very kind to UCSF and provided added resources to help us scale the work that we're doing. So if I were to just paint a quick picture of the evolution of the work we've done, when we first started, we had a centralized budget. And of course, our policy is written in such a way that anyone that's in a union have up to about 40 hours of work release time that they're still compensated for. Certainly dependent on your status, if you're part-time, if you are more than part-time, if you're full-time, it is an equivalent in terms of how much time you get to take off to go and pursue an education opportunity. And then for those that are not in the union, similar process that is already also written into that policy. So that was the first lever that we pull. We ensure that we continue to educate managers and leaders in the organization that this is a continued opportunity. And I will say at least 90% of our leadership, barring the new folks that just came on that are still learning our processes, of course, are fully aware of the opportunities to really engage in the policy-driven time away from work that we've really built in. And then the second piece was under the anchor institution mission, as well as HR, we did set aside, and we have consistently set aside added funds to support direct time away from work, also to support backfill, because it's not just paying. For example, I use myself as an example. If I were to go and participate in a program and I left work for a week, that's 40 hours of my time times whatever I earn per hour. That is replaced by the centralized funds that we have. In addition to that, my team may still need my expertise or someone with my expertise for that 40 hours. Whomever that individual is, we also cover that person's wages for that 40 hours to backfill that person. So in essence, we're doing 2x what the cost is, because we want to make sure that the department still is able to be effective and produce what they need to produce, as well as the employee does not miss any money on their paycheck the next pay period or out.
So let me jump right now to the RadTech new program that you're excited to share with us. You had talked about the Excel program, and tell us more about this RadTech program that you're launching.
Absolutely. And I would need to probably zoom out first before I talk about the RadTech program itself. When you think about the state of California, we've done a great job as a state ensuring that people see California as a place where they want to work in healthcare. We've done a tremendous job there. We've also done a tremendous job in supporting our community colleges and the educational facilities that support individuals who want to maybe get an associate's degree, but not necessarily a baccalaureate degree. The area that the healthcare industry as a whole, I will say across the country, but specifically in California, is facing is that we have an aging population. The population is nearing a point where added services, whether it be tertiary or quaternary care, is an increased demand on most healthcare providers in the state. What that means from a very practical level is that if I walked into a facility now and I said, I have maybe a pain in my shoulder, right? That requires potentially an MRI, an X-ray, or some form of imaging. And that is then added to the capacity of all the imaging devices that we have within the state of California. Now, if there is a wait list to get access to those imaging opportunities, we could probably see people wait in a week or two weeks, depending on what the need is. And to wait for something that is potentially life-threatening or life-impacting is not really a good situation. And so when we decided to launch the radiology program, we decided that it had to do three specific things. The first thing that I wanted it to do was to ensure that it was a pathway from our other pathways into greater economic mobility. I previously mentioned our practice coordinator training program. Those are individuals who get trained for about 4 months and they're able to start earning the salary, an hourly wage, pardon me, of somewhere around $30 to $32 an hour. We then have a secondary stepping stone, which is the medical assistant program. That is a 10 to 12 month training program in partnership with a local Bay Area entity that individuals are then trained, certified in phlebotomy, EKG, and they have an MA certification. They could then move into an MA job paying somewhere around $32 to maybe $34 an hour. And then the third step, which is right now in our second year of testing this pilot, is our radiology program, which once fully trained, an individual has the opportunity to earn somewhere between $120,000 and $144,000 per year. So the reason we're doing this is because, one, we wanted to ensure that people had opportunities for economic mobility. So going back to those individuals who are below the poverty level or at the poverty level, how do we help them have sequential gains? And then secondly, how do we ensure that this strategy is tied directly to the resources necessary to support the aging population, as well as the demands that we're going to be seeing in the next 3 to 5 years? And so we wanted to build a program that responded to the market, supported people economically in terms of wage gains. And then third and final, it had to be competitive and cost-effective enough that we were not going to send people into bankruptcy just because they wanted to gain a new career. And so what we've done, and I've approved it, is that we're making this first cohort and potentially subsequent cohorts completely free. So there is no tuition being charged to participants that are admitted into the program. We've also made it 18 months. The standard program is between 24 months to 36 months in the state of California. Because it's 18 months, we've had the chance to work closely with City Colleges of San Francisco to understand what are the prerequisites that people need to have before they get into the program. What are some of the other pieces of information that we should be teaching in the program that, you know, should you have equivalent experience that you may not necessarily need to go and do it again. And so we really looked through the entire curriculum and the delivery of the content to ensure that 18 months is time effective and that it really meets people where they are. Because when you think about a working adult, for example, to dedicate two or more years to an educational program is possible. Is it optimal for their time and their schedule? That's debatable. And so we wanted to make sure that 18 months was the benchmark that we set. And we are very happy to have our cohort of 18 individuals who are going to start in early September to be in diagnostic medical imaging. We will then scale our program from diagnostic medical imaging into IR and mammography cross-training. So for those who are employees right now, they're going to have the opportunity to do cross-training in IR and mammography. And then we're going to advance to CT by spring of 2027, where we're going to have a cohort of roughly 16 or so people going into the CT program. And then by fall of 2027, we're going to launch our MRI program. And so once again, I said this at the onset, but business strategy does not have to be separate from community benefit and altruism. I think they could be one and the same, where we're really being and continuing to be great neighbors in the city of San Francisco, and also understanding that our patients and their family have certain demands that we need to rise to the occasion to consistently meet now and going forward.
Well, what a beautiful set of designs that you've laid out here. Can I just clarify, Mike? So for example, the RadTech, you've set it up for internal employees to be able to make those sequences, or is it these are pre-hire?
The first cohort for diagnostic medical imaging has been and was open to internal incumbents, as well as external individuals that are going to be a part of the program. So about 25% of the incoming population is individuals who have never been a part of any of our training programs, and they're from the external environment, not necessarily specific communities, but just outside of UCSF in general.
And talk to us about the learn and earn aspects of, you know, when do you apply the apprenticeship model, the learn and earn model, especially as you're now incorporating employees or you have always incorporated employees into your workforce development?
Absolutely. So with the apprenticeship model, for us, because we have a pretty sizable population of participants in the first cohort that are employees, our goal is to ensure that, one, they have at least one wage gain throughout that process. And that is a part of our standard process that we've already built in and considered. And so a built-in wage gain over the 18 months that they're going to be participating with us most likely will occur somewhere around June or July of 2027 in terms of how we are calendaring those wage gains. In addition to that, for the individuals that are not yet working with us, my team will actively, in the next couple of weeks, start to interview those individuals for opportunities at UCSF, so that while they learn, they're able to earn an income at the same time. And as I mentioned earlier, be able to reimburse any wages lost because they're participating in a training program with us. At the conclusion of the didactic portion of their learning, which is around 1,300 hours or so, we plan to then have those individuals actively participate in hands-on clinical learning while they're also still being compensated for that added work. So what we've done is taken the generalized employment method, which is get a person a job, get them into the career that they want. And we've expanded it and said, well, if we could get somebody hired and we could also get them trained, why can't we make this an apprenticeship program? Why can't we have some guarantees built in for these individuals along the way? And so that is what we intend to do. And we are very, very fortunate to have great leadership in the radiology department that has been extremely supportive. And they are helping to design a lot of this work as well. I'd be remiss if I didn't share that GE Healthcare is also a key partner in this process. They are helping us to design the technology that may be necessary for the students to learn the skills that they need, whether it be virtual reality or whether it be some type of simulation that they may need. But GE has been integral in helping us to design the content and the opportunities as well.
So when you talk about providing an employment guarantee at the end to the students who have interviewed and have been selected, when does that take place in the process of the program? I mean, if it's too early, they're too raw and may not have the right interview skills yet and don't look polished. And if it's too late, maybe it doesn't position UCSF as strongly as you could. So would you share your lessons learned there?
Absolutely. Because we're a public entity, we do not technically offer guaranteed employment. What we do offer is guarantee to be reviewed and to be considered for an opportunity. And so we consider the relevant time and point where a person is going to be qualified at the highest level would be somewhere around the 16-month mark. And the reason I'm putting it there is because at that point, they should have completed not only their online learning modules or in-class learning modules, but they would have gained enough clinical experience at that point to be strongly considered for an opportunity at UCSF, given the job requirements that we have for the roles for diagnostic medical imaging. And so we are considering that an individual who starts with us by September of this year, ideally, knock on wood, should be qualified at the utmost level to sit for an interview to be considered by at least November of 2027. At the very latest, based on how we're preparing the curriculum.
So is the 16th out of the 18th month, is that at the end of the clinical?
That is towards the end of the clinical, where a majority of that would have been completed, yes.
Wonderful. Now, Mike, there's so many ways that we could explore your work. I'm actually curious, what advice would your current self give your younger version, the new Mike, you know, entering workforce development? What advice would you give him in terms of what are the best practices that work for healthcare specifically?
Very good question. The first thing that I would give my younger self is you are not going to be able to reverse things that took decades to do overnight. So be kind to yourself, give yourself grace. It takes time. The second thing that I would say is the importance of emphasizing that healthcare is a mini city. If you think about any major city in the United States of America, it has an IT department, it has a facilities team, it has finance and accounting folks, it has everything. And my younger self would say, emphasize the importance of allied health in healthcare, because the typical individual that engages with our work may presume that it's the bedside care or clinical related work that takes precedent. And those are critical jobs, don't get me wrong. Those are important folks, important jobs, and important roles. In addition to that, I would say that the other half of the people that make this organization great are the folks that you may never see, the folks that you may never have a chance to interact with directly because they're maintaining our HVAC system so that every room in the hospital has the proper temperature that it needs to. And because of that, my younger self would hopefully be much more informed about what a career pathway in healthcare really could look like. I know you're qualifying this to be specific to healthcare, but I would venture to say that almost any organization in any industry has a unique opportunity right now to consider apprenticeship models, to consider how career pathways help not only to retain and to deepen the engagement of their current staff, but also to be a value proposition and attract new individuals into the organization. I would have told my younger self that a career pathway is a strong value proposition, more so than a salary offer or more so than equity that you could provide in a company. Because if people could see that they could grow at an organization, they can make a direct impact, oftentimes you'll find that you have your strongest engagement, your strongest retention in those areas. And retention and engagement goes hand in hand when it comes to patient satisfaction, when it comes to reduction in costs for labor. And so those are some of the things I would tell my younger self.
You would be a good mentor to your younger self.
Thank you.
So on allied health roles, which you had suggested emphasizing to your younger self, where do you see the puck heading in terms of the evolution of allied health? What can you already see as signals?
In terms of allied health, I think we're all staring into the mirror about what's going on with the proliferation of AI and how it's advancing in all of our spaces. When it comes to allied health, I see more of our allied health professionals having a skill in that area, plus understanding or deep knowledge of AI and how it interacts and works in your environment. One quick example of this is, for example, somebody that works in facilities. that manages all the, I will use waste receptacles at this point as an example. We have Internet of Things. What is it to stop us from saying we have tracking or technology within those waste receptacles that alerts us at any given point about what the volume of waste in that bin is, so that we could deploy technology and deploy team members appropriately to receive or to retrieve that item? The reason I point that out is because before it may have been acceptable, which it probably still is in most cases, to have a functional understanding of just the job itself, which is good. But understanding how the job will transform in the next 5 to 10 years with the inclusion of automation or deeper AI technology is going to be critical for allied healthcare. For clinicians, I see that also still being true, but I think in the broader allied healthcare space, we have to become much more comfortable or at least understanding of the technology that is spearheading massive change in the workplace. AI has certainly multiple facets in terms of how it's viewed. I think in terms of preparing workers and workforce for what's here and what's coming, being informed is never a bad thing. I mean, you could decide how you want to deploy that knowledge, but I think being informed is one of the things that in allied healthcare that my team and I will consistently and continue to ensure that the people we support are well aware of. We are currently in the process right now of developing some AI training through one of the latest partnerships that we have that we could deploy to our own team members. Now, we understand that they're going to be, in some cases, in the UCSF Police Department, working with our public safety folks, or they may be at one of our clinics helping patients check in. But once again, that does not mean you should not have a general understanding or at least a grasp of what the technology that is now out there is. How you choose to deploy it is your own personal will, and I think everyone should consider what the ramifications are in terms of deploying these types of technology. But at the same time, once again, I think it's critical for allied health practitioners to understand the landscape and how AI can augment, make your work better, or impact your work in any other case going forward.
So, Mike, let's close out by asking you, what makes you optimistic about the future of care?
That's a very good question. I am optimistic about the future of care because I believe that a lot of healthcare systems across the country used to operate as monoliths that were standalone and may have not always shared much outside of what was clinically researched or done. However, what I am starting to see a lot more of is concerted efforts with healthcare partners across the region, especially in California, where I am, that we're saying, hey, we have this potential challenge where we need X number of people in this position or this role. We could train 100 people, but we could only hire 80. And another healthcare partner is coming in to say, well, we could hire the other 20, or we could help to train the other 20 to make sure that they could get the opportunities that they need. For me, that really gives me a lot of excitement, because what that's telling me is that more and more, we are recognizing that healthcare in some spaces is very homogenous. And what I could teach a medical assistant, barring knowing how my institution operate, what I could teach him fundamentally could be applicable to many other healthcare institutions across the board. And so I'm very excited to see that healthcare leaders across San Francisco, across the Bay Area, across California, are making concerted efforts to ensure that while you may not be the final destination for that individual, that we're helping to lift the entire economy of the state.
Well, I could not have had a better guest to echo the theme that workforce development and healthcare workforce development is a team sport and not an individual sport. I so enjoyed our time together, Mike. Thank you very much for being with us today.
Likewise. Thank you so much, Vaughn.
I'm Vantone Quinlevin with Futuro Health. Thanks for checking out this episode of Workforce RX. I hope you will join us again as we continue to explore how to create a future-focused workforce in the nation.